Today at Reader's Corner, Nicholas Kristof, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and co-author of A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Altruism seems to be built into our DNA. The recent emergence of social entrepreneurs and the dawn of the effective altruism movement, making a difference, is part of what gives us purpose. Yet not all altruism is created equal. In this encore edition of Reader's Corner, we talk with Nicholas Kristof about his book, now out in paperback, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. In the book, Kristof discusses our approach to altruism from a communal, practical, and neurological standpoint. Co-written with Cheryl Wu Dunn, fellow Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and Kristof's wife, the book focuses on individual stories of service, from a doctor in Somalia fighting for women's empowerment in the face of militant extremists to a former Navy SEAL giving his fellow veterans a new statewide mission. A regular columnist for The New York Times and contributor to CNN, Kristof is a two-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He joins us today by phone. Nicholas Kristof, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Hey, Bob. Good to speak to you.
So many times, recently especially, people get a little frustrated. They wonder how they can make a difference in the life of someone else. And you and your wife, Cheryl Wu Dunn, have written a book that does just that. Perhaps we could start with something you define early in the book as the otherize problem, how we tend to look at people who are from someplace else.
Yeah. So I tend to think that we have had a problem in recent decades with what I sometimes call an empathy gap. And that I think that empathy gap is particularly large with people who our minds perceive as different. People across a gulf of race or immigration status or religion. And then we, our minds subconsciously tend to otherize these people and see them as not like us and maybe a little less deserving of empathy. And I should also actually say across an income gap, I think we tend to do this to people who are struggling economically. And there have even been brain scans of affluent people. And it turns out that when one looks at photos of people who are homeless, for example, that the brain processes those people not as human beings, but as objects, as things. So I think this is this tendency to otherize is a deeply human tendency, but also one that makes it a lot harder to address social problems, to push for opportunity for all.
And when it comes to giving back, you actually cite the World Giving Index, and you give the United States, the people of the United States, credit for generosity. But interestingly enough, we come in third. And that's kind of interesting. And if you could also explain the bottom 20% and the top 20%, which really gets into some interesting research by at least one professor down in Berkeley about how it is that those who are more wealthy don't seem to have quite the giving interest or capacity that the bottom 20% do.
Yeah. So in general, Americans are pretty generous by global standards, but Australians in particular exceed us according to some of those cross-cultural comparisons. And there's a significant difference in socioeconomic status that, as you say, it doesn't really make a lot of sense. The bottom 20% of Americans are significantly more generous in terms of charitable giving as a fraction of incomes than the top 20%. And that's surprising, both because obviously those at the bottom have less slack, and also because they get no tax advantage by giving because they're not itemizing deductions, they're not able to deduct those charitable contributions, while affluent people can. And the explanation for that seems to be a question of how we insulate ourselves from need. And if you are affluent today in America in a way that was not true a generation ago, then you are largely insulated from need. You know, you probably live in a nice neighborhood. You probably work with people who are also relatively affluent professionals, and you're intellectually aware of need, but it's not something that you encounter regularly. And in contrast, if you're poor in America today, then every day you encounter people needier than yourself. And confronted by that need, you reach into your pocket and help. And one indication that that is the dynamic that drives giving is that affluent people who live in economically diverse neighborhoods are substantially more generous than those who live in areas that are uniformly affluent.
Boy, that really rings true with me in my own experience. I had a son who, during a significant period of his life, lived in the Mission District in San Francisco. And whenever I would visit him and his friends, I was always struck by how sensitive they were to those around them who needed more than they needed. And my son and his friends weren't exactly in the category of the top 20%, but it was very clear that these are folks who on a daily basis are staring poverty in the face. And as a result of that, have this keen sense of how they should be giving back.
Well, good for your son, I must say. And I think that, you know, one challenge for all of us is to try to escape this bubble and try to get through that insulation, partly so that we don't otherize people and understand the complexities of struggles, of economic struggles. And, you know, I guess I also think that when people are just surrounded by others who are well off, then one unfortunate consequence can be that we can see economic struggles not only as an economic issue, but also as a moral one. And see moral failure, even in kids, and thus resist not only personal charitable giving, but also government efforts to address that kind of need. And I think that just sometimes leads to really bad policies. My own view is that one of our most catastrophic policies over the last 50 years was the war on drugs, and that this led to mass incarceration. Since 1970, we increased incarceration rates in America sevenfold. That led a lot of people to end up with criminal records that made them less employable, less marriageable. Only 10% of Americans who have addictions get treatment. And there's just been such devastation, not least that 65,000 Americans died last year of overdoses. And I think we would have been better off as a country with more compassionate policies. I think finally we're actually beginning to get there. But boy, what devastation to families, to individuals, to the country that has caused in the meantime.
Well, your book does a marvelous job of identifying and reporting on so many people, one person who made a difference. And let's just single out a couple of those to give our readers an opportunity to see what you've done here. Shoshana Klein. She worked with an outfit called First Step. And I wonder if you could describe for us the difference she makes in the life of one person.
So Shoshana Klein, so this has to do with a congenital problem in which the foot is turned inward. And so we don't really notice it in the U.S. because it's corrected at birth. And it turned out when we were writing the book, that my mom had actually had this this congenital foot problem called club foot, and I'd never known about it. You know, my mom walks around; there's no indication. And Shoshana Klein actually as well. She was a athlete in college, but she had this vague knowledge that when she was born, that she had been born with a club foot, and then it had been corrected when she was a baby. And but meanwhile, around the world, there are an awful lot of kids who are born with club foot on one or both feet, and they don't get it corrected. And then they end up unable to walk. They often become beggars. They're unable to go to school, unable to marry. And this is something that can be fixed really cheaply, about $500 a kid, and it gives them their life back. You know, there are a lot of really complex problems around the world, a lot of problems that don't have easy solutions. Clubfoot is one that has a really easy solution. And so Shoshana figured that, you know, she'd had this problem solved, but for her, because she had the good luck to be born in the U.S., that in a lot of places that wouldn't happen. And so she supported groups like First Step that that correct it. And so what we were trying to convey there is that, you know, people are often skeptical of charities or groups that help. And, you know, that's legitimate. There are some charities really do waste money or even defraud people. But there are also just problems that are solvable that make this life-changing difference for very modest sums of money. And it's so inspiring when you see that.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and co-author of A Path Appears. One of the most powerful stories in your book involves a Somali woman, Dr. Abdi, standing up to the militants in her fight for women's empowerment. Can you share that story with us?
Yeah. In Somalia, there was a really radical group of Muslim extremists that was taking over the hospital that Dr. Abdi had set up. She was trained as a doctor, as a gynecologist, and had set up this extraordinary hospital not so far from Mogadishu. And in the absence of any real government in Somalia, this had provided services to vast numbers of people. It had then become something of a refugee camp when people were displaced by war. And it was providing education. It was training people to get jobs. And then these extremists thought that a woman shouldn't be running anything. And so they came in, guns blazing, and evicted Dr. Abdi. But they couldn't run a hospital. And so they didn't really know what to do. And meanwhile, these tens of thousands of people whom Dr. Abdi was keeping alive grew increasingly angry at the radicals and were demanding that they actually let things work again. And so finally, the radicals kind of shamefacedly went back to Dr. Abdi and said, okay, you can take over again. And she made them sign a apology. And they left tail between their legs, and she took over the operations again. And, you know, my favorite thing that she did there was she also set up a little jail cell for men who beat their wives.
President Carter's played a significant role in Africa over the years, and you talk about his work fighting the Guinea worm. I must admit, I didn't know much about that until I read your book. Could you explain?
Guinea worm is a parasite that is excruciating, and what happens is that people drink from a contaminated source, and they get the worm inside them. It grows about 3 feet long. It's like a little white spaghetti, and then when it's at full length, it causes terrible pain and itching. And the way that people deal with that is they go in the water to ease the pain. And when you were in the water, the worm pops through the skin and dumps its eggs into that water source for future people to be infected. And, you know, it's excruciatingly painful. It's humiliating to have this long 3-foot worm inside you. And when it is at full length, the only way to take it out is to pull it out about an inch a day and spool it around something. Because if you try to pull more, then it'll just break and leave most of the worm inside you. And this is there's a reference in the Bible to, I think it's fiery serpents inside people, and that is thought to be a reference to guinea worm. This was a very common parasite around much of the world, and President Carter, in his post-presidency, decided that he was going to lick it. And he has been so successful in doing that. It is on the verge of eradication. It's down to just one or two countries now. It's in Chad, in kind of north central Africa. And I think it's now actually gone from South Sudan, which was the biggest place. And I visited some of these places where President Carter has done the work. And it really looks as if this disease is going to be eradicated because of President Carter. He told me that it was kind of a race to the death to see who would outlast the other, whether it would be him or a guinea worm that would survive the other. And I think I'm betting on President Carter.
I can't agree more. Well, there are so many examples in your book of these brilliant ideas and these folks who come from nowhere to make a difference in the lives of others. But the Cook Stove Initiative is an example that you're trying to give the reader as to not all brilliant ideas turn out the way we would like them to.
That's right. And it's, I think, an argument for really relying on evidence, not just hunches. So the idea for clean cook stoves is that very often in poor countries, people cook with wood on these little fires inside cooking huts. And this is bad in a lot of ways. It uses a lot of wood. Women often have to trudge for hours to get the wood and bring it back. Kids are sometimes pulled out of school so that they can collect firewood. It produces huge amounts of smoke inside these little cooking huts that is incredibly damaging to women's health in particular. And so it makes eminent sense to, instead of having these old-fashioned little cook fires, to use specially built cook stoves that are much, much more fuel efficient, that use a lot less of that firewood. And there have been experiments where they dramatically reduce the smoke, dramatically reduce the fuel. And so a lot of aid groups were very excited about these. The U.S. State Department allocated $100 million to introduce them. And then a economist at MIT decided to measure, well, exactly how much do they improve people's health? And she used a tool that is increasingly common and really important. It's sort of the gold standard of evidence. It's called a randomized controlled trial. And that means that basically you test an intervention just as if it were a pharmaceutical trial. So there were a bunch of villages. Half of them were assigned randomly to get clean cook stoves, and the other half were not. And then everybody's health was measured at the beginning and at the end. And what she found was that the clean cook stoves made no difference in people's health. And it turned out that, you know, in a small-scale experiment, and people used the cook stoves, and they were quite helpful. But in the real world, they tended to break. People got sick of them. They didn't much like them. They didn't use them as much. And so at least for the first generation of clean cook stoves, they really did not work. And to me, you know, the lesson is that there are a lot of great ideas we can have sitting around a conference table in New York or Washington or Boise, and that it's really important to test these interventions and test them carefully, rigorously, robustly. You know, helping people is harder than it looks. And one of the great areas of progress today compared to 25 years ago is that we have more of these rigorous randomized controlled trials that give us a much better sense now than we used to have of what really works in trying to address poverty both abroad and at home.
You know, Nick, even your book, as it spans the globe, is not exactly a mystery to many of us who live here in Boise, as we encounter and live alongside people from all parts of the world. I'm fascinated in your book, not just by the examples we've been talking about of women and men who have made a difference in the lives of their neighbors, but also when you get into the neuroscience of altruism. You go to your home state of Oregon, both the University of Oregon and Oregon State, to get some really interesting research evidence of what happens when an individual decides to make a difference. Talk to us about the science of altruism.
Sure. I think we often tend to think that giving back, helping others is a sacrifice. It can be an economic sacrifice. It can be a sacrifice of time. And there's increasingly been really solid research, both in social psychology and in neuroscience, showing that actually there are tremendous selfish gains to helping others, that there's a selfish pleasure in helping others. It does seem that it varies from person to person, that some people get more of this pleasure by helping others, but that it is, you know, broadly true. And so the experiment that I participated in at the University of Oregon involved people who were having their brain scanned as they were both receiving. You're looking at a screen as your brain is being examined. And in some cases, you are receiving money. And in other cases, you are making donations to charities. And it turned out that for about half of people, the pleasure centers of their brain lit up as much when they were giving as when they were getting. And that seems to be, you know, I think one of the kind of the failures of a lot of us to understand that we really are social creatures, that we evolved to support those around us, and that we are hardwired to feel empathy for individuals around us. And when we find a sense of purpose, when we support those around us, this really gives us a rush of pleasure. And yet I think too often, partly because we are busy and so on, we deny ourselves this pleasure.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Nicholas Kristof, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and co-author of A Path Appears. In the book, Kristof uses powerful stories to reveal why we give and how we can use science to make altruism more effective. At the end of the book, you give the readers some tips on where they might go to make a difference. Obviously, one of those is volunteering. I believe you talk in your book about some health benefits that may occur as a result of that.
That's right. There have been some great studies on people who volunteer and that they live longer, and especially in retirement. There's been quite a few studies that when people retire, they lose the sense of identity that comes with their job, the sense of purpose that comes with their job. And this is true of blue-collar jobs as well as white-collar. And one way to compensate for that and to find a new sense of purpose is to volunteer, to get engaged with a new cause, to something that is larger than oneself. And so there was one great study that showed that people who are retired, that one thing that helps them live longer is to join a church or other religious organization that gives them a sense of purpose or engagement in the larger community. Another thing that helps the people live longer is to work out regularly. But the thing that really boosted them was to volunteer regularly, and that was even more helpful in promoting their physical health. And I think that, you know, increasingly we're finding that what we think of as altruism and helping others is also a selfish pleasure, that it's in a strange way, one of the things that one can do for oneself is to find ways of gaining that sense of purpose through helping others.
I think at one point in your book, you say that if we're not careful, we could paralyze ourselves into thinking that global problems are hopeless. And one of the points that you make at the outset of your book is that you are hopeful when it comes to what we're doing around the globe and the prospects for the future.
There is this really frustrating belief in America that global poverty is getting worse. 90% of Americans say in polls that since 1990, global poverty has either gotten worse or stayed the same. And this is a profound misunderstanding of what has happened around the world. You know, since 1990, the number of kids dying each year has dropped by more than half. That's more than 6 million kids' lives saved each year. Overall, since 1990, it's more than 100 million kids' lives saved because of things like vaccines or simple diarrheal treatments, better care for malaria, and likewise education. That, you know, until the 1960s, the majority of human beings had always been illiterate. And because we vastly expanded education around the world in poor countries, now almost 90% of people worldwide are illiterate. And that's a huge gain. It's, you know, nothing is more transformative than an education becoming literate. There are so many of these diseases, like guinea worm, that are on the decline, in some cases, like guinea worm and polio, probably on their way out in the next few years. And so, yes, there are enormous problems with refugees, Syria, Yemen. There's so many really frustrating problems around the world. Poverty remains a big problem. But I think we have to recognize that the backdrop is also a huge amount of progress against global disease, illiteracy. And that progress should in turn galvanize us to push the last little bit and make greater progress. Every day, I think it is another 300,000 people graduate from extreme poverty to something that is probably still poverty, but not this extreme poverty of less than $2 per person per day.
Perfectly stated. And I must admit, I did have one final question that I wanted to ask you. First of all,
Absolutely. Thanks
for your New York Times column. It's just such a great way to keep up with what's going on around the world. And we so much appreciate what you have to say. And in a sense, this question spins off of your book. Your book has a publication date of 2014. Since the 2016 election, I think it's fair to say there's a bit of narcissism in the air. That puts it mildly. And if you were to write this book today and document or report on any uptick or reaction or changes in the tempo or the level of service in either generosity, volunteer efforts, what would you have to say?
So right now, actually, my wife and I are working on a new book that will come out next year. So,
oh, good.
So we're kind of answering that question, Bob, in a broader sense. But what strikes me, so I'm from rural Oregon in an area that is Trump country. And what strikes me is the degree to which people are in desperate need of better social services, better education, better support for kids, better drug treatment programs, and how people are literally dying for lack thereof. You know, life expectancy has dropped for 2 years in a row in the U.S. In a way that it is not in other countries. And that's because of these problems. And yet the response has been, in many cases, for people to kind of out of desperation to vote for President Trump. It seems to me that both President Trump and Bernie Sanders benefited in 2016 from this just desperate sense that things were not working, that traditional elites had not responded to their needs. So I think that President Trump was elected in part as a response to that sense of desperation. But in my view, he in turn has compounded the problems. Healthcare, for example, we used to rank in the middle of the OECD industrialized countries in terms of health outcomes. And since then, other countries have all improved. We are now near the bottom in terms of child mortality, in terms of life expectancy. And I believe President Trump's efforts to undermine the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid have compounded these health inequities in the U.S., the health disparities between the U.S. and Canada, or between the U.S. and Europe. One of my seventh grade crush, in fact, an old friend, she suffered from meth issues, from homelessness as a consequence of drug issues. Her daughter is affected, and she told me that the only time in her life she voted was in 2016 to go and vote for President Trump because she was so desperate for change. And I understand that, but my fear is that the policies since then have only exacerbated these inequities.
Nicholas Kristof, thank you so much for joining us at Reader's Corner. Thank you for the book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of Reader's Corner. Next week, author John Ray talks with us about the gripping novel Godsend. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.